the meeting for questions. As a reminder, please be aware that if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the Light a Candle podcast. Welcome to the OA Light a Candle meeting podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find links to prior podcasts from this meeting available in multiple formats. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, John Kay.
Hi, I'm John. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, John.
I was showing this to Seppi. It always cracks me up. I've been in AA and sober for a long time, and I've actually hit the point of hitting over 40 years. I'm older than dirt. But on my 40th, I always get, they have these little medallions, and I always get a new one every year, you know. So a while back, I hit 40, and it says XL. No compulsive eater ever wants to see XL anywhere. So anyway, I want to thank Seppi for asking me, and it's been a while since I've been here. I'm going to do this as quick as I can because I want to get to what happened and what it's like now, because that's the really important stuff. The numbers. Okay, I have been in OA for 42 years. I've been abstinent for about 28, maintaining about 105-pound weight loss for most of that time. And you'll notice, if you can do basic math, that 42 and 28, there was relapse in there. And that's a big part of my story. It's a big part of what I try to tell people, that you can be in the worst relapse in the world, and I really think I was, but you can get out of it. You know, it's not a fatal condition. It's not something that can't be done. So my training in being a compulsive eater started way young. I grew up the child of two different alcoholics that divorced, but I kept going back and forth between them. And it was crazy. It was chaotic. I won't go through all that other than to say that I got a couple of really bad messages. We say bad modeling now. And that was, you get it from your parents, you know. And what I learned was, don't ever talk about your feelings. You know, we'll talk to you about politics and sports. Don't talk about your feelings. If you have some feeling and it's stupid, you don't have it. You know, override it, you know. And the other thing is, there would be crazy stuff happen, and then the next day, everything's fine, you know, pay no attention to the car coming out of the front window, everything's fine, you know. But the most important thing I got, not a good thing, is that when my parents would get upset, either of them, they would immediately say, I need a drink, I need a cigarette, I need a pill, I need something. And what that taught me, even though I didn't know it at the time, is that if I don't like how I'm feeling in here, there's something out there I can put in here to make it feel better. And for me, at a very early age, that was food. Because I had crazy, chaotic time. I moved. My mother was big on what they call geographic cures. We moved all over the country. Now it doesn't matter. You can go anywhere in this country and look around and think you're in the same place, because there's always an Apple store, there's always a this, there's always a that. But when I was new and I moved from New York to Florida, and as we went over the border, it said, "Welcome to Florida, United Clans of America." And I was like, "Mom, I want to go home." But anyway, we bounced around, and I never made friends for very long. I was usually by myself. I was a loner, and I only had two friends, salt and sugar. You know, I could actually max out on sugar, and then I would move to salt, and then I would go back to sugar and salt, and that's the comfort I needed when I was young. You know, I know that, you know, the guy. Well, actually, he just passed away. Clancy from AA, and he always talks about some people need the substance, because if you don't have that, you can't sober up a corpse. And so I needed that food. I don't know what would happen if I hadn't had that. So anyway, I grow up, and just like everybody else, first of all, it's miserable to be a fat kid. I don't know who grew up as fat kid. I've been fat kid. I've been fat adult. Fat kid, way worse. You know, people are just brutal. I got beat up for being a fat kid. And the thing was, I was like the brainiac. I mean, one of the gifts I did get was a really great brain. And so I wanted to make sure, and this happened all the way into coming into the program. When I came in and you met me, I had to make sure you knew just how smart I was as quick as I could, you know? And sometimes that would be, you know, correcting your English. And, you know, no better way to make friends than correcting his English. But I needed to do that because I felt so like shit inside. I felt so shit about my body and how I was that this was the only little thread of self-esteem I could grab onto. And the trouble with that is that just, you know, estranged me from my fellows that much more. I'm the fat kid and I'm the geek who screws up the curve, you know, in school. And so I really grew up, and I think it wasn't until I got in my first program, I sort of felt that there were, like, if you think of a Venn diagram, there was John and the rest of the world, and they didn't overlap. And it took me a while to be in here and to realize, you know, I am just like everybody else. When you work the steps, to me, 6 and 7 get you realizing, you know, that, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I have all the same flaws. I have all the same annoying things and things I'm embarrassed about. But the most important thing is I'm teachable now because I realize I'm not any better than anybody else. You know, we had a guy, and Seppi, you may remember, God, I can't think of his name now. I'm getting that age, you know. Oh, Murray. And Murray was this wonderful guy, and he came in and he ended up having a relapse, and he'd gotten down, lost like 300 pounds or something like that. And he relapsed and then came back in and then he relapsed. And all of a sudden, you know, one of the lousiest things you hear in OA is when somebody comes up and says, "Did you hear about Murray?" And you know immediately what that's going to be. And the thing about Murray is he was absolutely a genius. Murray made me feel like Rain Man because he was literally a rocket scientist. There are things on the moon that Murray put there. And it taught me, it doesn't matter. Murray's the smartest guy in the graveyard. You know, all of this brain is of absolutely no use when it comes to this disease. And that's the really frustrating thing, is you think this would help. Anyway, let me just fast forward. I didn't, you know, all the way through school, I was overweight. I didn't go to the prom. I didn't have any girlfriends. I hung out with all the other misfits. And I was never going to touch alcohol because, you know, this wonderful brain read a lot of stuff about alcoholism. Oh, if you're a child of alcoholics, you probably got a good chance of becoming one. So I'm not going to touch it. The trouble is I'm an 18-year-old, you know, I don't know how much I weigh, 250-plus pound kid who's terribly shy, especially around women. And I found this magic elixir that when I took it, I turned into like James Bond, you know? Hello, darling. Yeah. And it automatically, this was the answer, you know? So I mentioned that only, I know this isn't an AA meeting, but it was the first time I was able to lose weight for any amount of time. And the way I did it was I transferred my sugar to the liquid form, right? And then I did crazy dieting and crazy exercise. What I would do is I would go a week without eating, and then I'd binge on a Saturday night. And then I'd go another week without eating. And, you know, if you're like an 18, 19-year-old boy, you're going to lose weight like that because you got the metabolism of a hummingbird at that age. But the thing is, I can look back now and go, you know, somewhere in here I knew there was no dimmer switch on this, right? There was only off and on, you know? In electronics, it's called a duty cycle, okay? If I could keep it off as much as I could get to a normal weight. And I did. I got to a normal weight. I had my first relationship. The trouble is, I had awoken the tiger, right? And all of a sudden, then alcohol took over. And after a certain amount of time, the relationship went away. I gained back all the weight and then some, you know, because I was choke. I said I was fat, then I was a drunk, and then I was a fat drunk because I merged the two together. And I won't go through the whole thing, but I knew after a certain amount of time I need to get to AA, because I was to AA meetings with my mother when I was a kid. AA was great because they had all those donuts in the back. And I got to sit back there and then they take a break and everybody go, where happened to all the donuts? I don't know. But I knew I needed it, except I didn't want anything to do with you bunch of religious freaks. And I remember I went into a detox. And I got out, and being it actually threw me out. You know what you got to, how obnoxious you have to be to get thrown out of a detox? Because I knew it all, and they knew there was not going to be anything they could teach me. So being a good alcoholic, I went out and got drunk that night. But then I was drawn to this meeting that taken me to. And I remember it was a Sunday morning meeting. And I don't remember what the meeting was about, but I know I was helping put away chairs and talking to some old timer. And I was like, I can't be part of this religious group. And he said, oh, he says, it's not religious, it's spiritual. And I went, no, it isn't. Look at the steps. God, 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 God. You know, him with a capital H. And he looked at it, and he looked at me, and he said, okay, leave it out. Now, my brain just like locked. What? I said, leave it out. You can stay here till you're 120 years old. Nobody's ever going to tell you you have to believe anything. Nobody's ever going to tell you you have to believe in a particular thing. He said one thing, just try to keep an open mind. Try to just keep an open mind. And that was like the little mustard seed that got stuck in the door. Because, you know, I've heard other people tell newcomers, just keep coming, you'll get it. You'll get the God thing. That would have sent me out just as much because I was paranoid. Oh, my God, the Scientologists are going to get me. So I came in AA. I immediately started going back to the crazy dieting because I wanted to lose all the weight I gained when I was eating and drinking like crazy. And, of course, that crashed and burned. I ended up having a relapse in that program. And I knew when I came back what the real problem. So, you know, you come into one program, you find out about all the other programs you should be in, right? What do they say? If you're not in three programs, you're in denial somewhere. But anyway, I had heard about OA, and all of a sudden it made sense, you know, because I knew about AA, and went, of course, why have I not been able to do this my whole life? And now I understand. So when I came back from my relapse, I said to the guy who was my sponsor, I need to go to OA, you know? And he, you know, in AA, you're newly sober. No, don't worry about it. Here, have a chocolate bar, you know? Because it's even in the big book, by the way. And I said, no, you don't understand. These two things are intertwined. I have to work on these. And he was like, okay, I told you what meetings I want you to go to. Whatever the hell else you do, I don't care, you know? And I said, deal, you know? So I came to OA and I fell in love immediately with it because all of a sudden everything made sense. And, you know, it all just came crystal clear. And I was in a little right after Grace Sheet went out because they had the original Dignity of Choice. And I still remember it was number two of the six they had. And I became obsessed with the food plan. And I became, that was all it was about. And I always joke about the fact that I have been every iteration of this disease. I've been a compulsive eater. I have been a bulimic. I have been an exercise bulimic. And for this one tiny time, I was an anorexic. And what happened is this. If you grow up as a fat kid, the idea of goal weight is like it's a panacea, you know, rainbow out there. You can hear angels singing. And I knew if I just get to the goal weight, that will make everything better. And so I had this magic number in my head. And well, you know, again, I'm young and I lose weight pretty quickly. And I got to that number. And the only thing that happened is I got to that number. I didn't like myself anymore. I didn't feel any more confident. And so I went, oh, must not be the right number. So I lost another 10 pounds. And no, I'm still horribly shy. I still have all kinds of shame and doubt and everything. So I lose another 10 pounds. And by now, people are coming up to me because this is like, I don't know, you know, it was during the AIDS crisis. And they're, are you all right? You know? And I got to say, this dumb Irishman had to go through that. Because I've heard for years, and I had the proof there's no number on a scale that's going to make me like myself. There's no number on a scale that's going to make me feel self-confident. There's no number. And I really needed to do that. And I remember, you know, I was doing pretty well, and then my sponsor left program, and I'm like, well, I got the other program, I don't need that, you know, and that lasted for a while, you know. My disease is real patient, you know. I think it was a year I went, and then, you know, one night I was a stand-up comic for about 15, 20 years. I remember we were in after a show in New York. Oh, we're all going down to Chinatown. Come on. And I'd already had my third meal. And what? Oh, okay. You know, and that was it. It was off to the races. And then I was in and out and in and out. I still managed to maintain a reasonably normal weight. I ended up getting married. And then we moved out here. And when I moved out here, my program fell apart totally. Okay. I just couldn't do it. And I always talk about, in OA, I really don't think it's as much a relapse as it is a relapse cycle. You know, a week on, a week off, a month off, right? And that's what it was with me. And it was miserable because I remember I was the secretary of Artists in Abstinence, right? And I'm a secretary of that meeting. I have a sponsor. I'm a delegate for Intergroup. I was a sponsor. Now, I shouldn't have been sponsor or secretary, but we can talk about that some other time. And still, I left that meeting and stopped at the donut shop on the way home. And I remember walking out one day, what am I doing? I'm not sentenced to OA. If I don't want to be here, I don't have to be here. But, you know, that's that pitiful, comprehensible demoralization, you know, that it just doesn't make any sense, you know. And so that went along for quite a while. And I found another program for a while that had a very rigid food plan, and that worked for a while. But one of the problems is the food plan became an authority figure, you know, and it's not going to work for me as an authority figure. I always say to sponsees, the one thing I never want to hear you say is the word can't. I can't eat sugar. I can't eat flour. Sure you can. We'll take you to Costco. You can buy a big-ass thing or whatever. I say it has to become I choose not to. Because as long as it's I can't, it's an authority figure. It's something being imposed on me. And, you know, I might knuckle under to get what you promised me, but sooner or later I'm going to rebel. And it has to be I don't want to go back to where I was when I was doing this stuff, you know? And so anyway, I eventually got abstinent, and I came back to OA. And I joked that I was in two different OAs, the one before that program and one after. The one before program was all about going to meetings, hanging out with friends, going out for coffee afterwards, getting on the phone, gossiping about everybody else, you know. No big book, no steps, no nothing, right? And it's so funny. I remember we were goofing one day. We left some meeting at the log cabin. We were kidding. I think it might have been Jack Z. He was somebody who was a real big book thumper. And we were like, God, if I had to hear him talk about the steps one more goddamn time. And we were all laughing about it. So I went to that other program for a couple of years. And when I came back, all those people were gone. You know who was still there? The guy with the big book, you know? And so it started to dawn on me. And things really did start to change a little. Except then I ended up relapsing again. And that's when that relapse cycle really happened for a while. And it's miserable, you know. And the thing I figured out, you know, hopefully I've been graced with abstinence now for quite a while. And actually, I just celebrated, I guess, 28 in March 5th. Anyway, woo-hoo! But, you know, it was so unbelievably miserable to do that, you know, because by then I knew better. I knew what I should be doing and I couldn't do it. And I can look back now. I think one of the things that happened is I became very involved in working with relapse people and doing relapse workshops and stuff because I really did begin to understand it. But you know, the thing is, I'm not a genius. I can't understand it that way. I can only understand it in my rearview mirror. And what I finally got was I never accepted the concept of powerlessness about the food. You know? I'm a great little student. You come in, you tell me what to say, I'll parrot it right back to you. You know? And I did. I'm powerless over food. And then I'd go eat. And then I'd come back. I'm powerless over food. And then I'd go eat. Right? Well, how powerless did I actually think I was? You know? Was I sitting there saying, oh, the hell with OA, I'm not going to come back? No. I mean, I didn't think about it at all at the time, but what was in there was, When I'm done, I will come back and I will get abstinent again. And the reason is, I had empirical proof I could. And if you think about it, if you've gone out and you've relapsed and come back and relapsed and come back, whether you want to say it to yourself or not, there's a part of you going, wait a minute, I've gotten abstinent back again. And it was true. I am powerful over the food in the small picture. But what happened, and I think it was when the light bulb went off. Every once in a while, thoughts come into my head that I go, where the hell did that come from? And I sort of think of it as a higher power. I remember I had a couple of weeks and I blew it again. And I'm sitting there going, why did I blow it again? I had a couple of weeks. And a little voice said, you didn't have a couple of weeks. You haven't been abstinent since you first came in the program. And I thought about it and go, you know, it's true. I had a commitment. I was really willing to go to any lengths and do all that. And I lost it. And so it changed the way I looked at things. You know, in the old days, I'm getting that age you say that too much. You used to hear that from the podium. We don't eat no matter what. You know, in fact, I think you had to actually bang a podium when you said it. And I heard somebody at the Hill Street meeting say one day, I thought it was perfect, and it just changed how I thought of it. She said, her sponsor said, if you've made food an option, it's always going to be the only option. It's always going to be the path of least resistance. If you're going through upset and turmoil and you can go eat something that A, you like, and B, makes you feel better, it's a no-brainer. Who wouldn't pick that of the two? And so I realized it had to come off, you know, my thing, options. And, you know, Terrell says, if it's not an option, it's not a problem. And it's true. You know, I had made it an option. And it was really a thing that changed, you know. I mean, I've had a couple of trajectory changes in my life, you know, AA and then OA. And I mean, I always think about those. You see a lot of these things about alternate universes. Well, in an alternate universe, I'm dead for 30 years because I didn't find AA and I didn't find OA. So anyway, I mean, it's just such an interesting thing to start to look back and think about that relapse and how things change. You know, because I knew if I relapse, I would eventually grind that to a halt again. I knew that. I may have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a new sponsor, do a lot of writing, but eventually the food would stop again. But the trouble was, as soon as it did, the clock was ticking on when I was going out again. And the thing I saw later, and again, only in the rearview mirror, is I was on a years-long in-and-out cycle, and I deluded myself into thinking that some of those ins were abstinence. And they really weren't. They were just an in on an in-and-out cycle. And the way I use it as a comparison, I can run for 300 yards and then sit down in a chair. And then I can get up and run another 300 yards and sit down in a chair. And I can do that for 26.2 miles versus running a marathon. Well, that's what long-term abstinence really is. It's a marathon. It's being willing to deal with every piece of crap life has to throw at you, you know? And I love, there's a great quote in on page 450, 451 of the big book that says, I'm going to butcher it, but there's something about the tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse. I cannot allow my sobriety or abstinence to be dependent on them. Because there's always going to be ups, there's always going to be downs. And again, the growth for me came from not continuing to self-medicate, was what I was doing. You know, I just didn't like how I felt about myself or about the world. And using this stuff changed how I looked at the world, you know. But when it changed is when the food went down, it's when the real change really started, you know. Because then I really got into the steps more. I had to deal with life unvarnished. You know, I was down that. I always joke, I'm a drug and alcohol counselor now, and I always joke, whatever the last one is the one that's going to be the toughest. Because we keep bouncing around, little whack-a-mole thing. I was out of them. So I had to deal with life unvarnished. And sometimes it's just not easy, you know. And again, I was able to look back, and I'll just talk a little about the steps, because they really did change me, you know. Again, the first one about powerlessness, I just told you. The second was a little hard. When you hear the word insanity in the second step, you go, wait a minute. I do all these other things. How insane am I? And I came across a wonderful definition of insanity once. It said, a state of mind that prevents normal perception. And I was like, that's it. You know, think of what sanity is. What is sanity? Well, for the most part, it's dealing with life and making 1,000 decisions all the time, right? You come in, where am I going to sit? I'm going to sit there, I'm going to do this. And we do a great job with it. Why? Because we got this wonderful computer that God gave us up here that does it and does a wonderful job. And how does it manage to do that? It takes in the input via perceptions. Except in this one area, well, two in my case, I have a disease that perception is skewed. And so I like to say, if you think of it as a computer, my disease is corrupting the data I'm using to make a good decision. That's why a guy can sit at a bar and put a glass of whiskey and milk and think, that'll be fine. Remember Jim from the Big Book? That'll be fine. I can put whiskey in the milk, it'll be fine. And we all laugh at that, you know? And you will probably laugh too, Jim. But just not until the next day, right? How many times have we gotten up and said, what the hell was I thinking, right? And that's what this disease does. It's so cunning, baffling, and powerful. I talk about it. I use the my thing that I'll talk to sponsees about. I think it is like the world's best salesman, you know? If you think of somebody you know as a salesman and they're smooth and they're likable and all that, and they're trying to sell you the food, you know, to get you to go eat. And the thing is that salesman is there all the time. When you're in a relapse, just chirping in your ear 24/7. Now imagine this is a salesman that can also read your mind. You know, imagine if you went into like a car dealership and the guy could read your mind. You know, no matter what you said, you're going to walk out with a car. And that's what it does, because my disease would always have the answer. Well, I shouldn't do that, and I did. I did it over and over. The salesman made the sale. And the thing I said that's the most evil about it is if he did make the sale, he then put his arm around me and said, oh, and by the way, this was your idea. It really wasn't my idea. If it was my idea, I wouldn't have been going to 5 meetings a week. I wouldn't have been secretary. I wouldn't have been a sponsor or a sponsee. But in that moment of impulse, it's my idea. And the more that I can see the disease as something outside me, the better I can deal with it, you know? And then, I had to find a power greater than myself. And the higher power I have today is nothing like what I grew up with. And I for the most part, I just use the phrase, everything's happening the way it's supposed to. I don't have to like it. I don't have to agree with it. But I just have to accept it. And if I can, my life just goes so much easier, you know? Because most of the time, anything I have to accept is something I don't like, right? We don't sit there going, oh, I have to accept I hit the lottery. but it's going to be something we don't like. And almost all the time, it's going to be something that can't be changed. If it's a person who's like gotten you all pissed off, then that person isn't thinking about it at all, right? If it's a circumstance, there's no thinking of it. I'm the only one that's churning up my guts constantly every time I think about it. And I tell people where I work, I said, acceptance is a very selfish thing. And I mean selfish in the good definition of the word selfish, meaning I'm taking care of myself. Because if I can learn to accept things, I'm saying, okay, maybe I'm not doing it for Gandhi-like reasons, but I'm saying, you're done living rent-free in my head. You're done. I'm not going to let you be my puppet, you know? One of the greatest lines I ever heard was in an Al-Anon meeting. Somebody said, act, don't react. And I went through life so reactive that there might as well have been puppeteers doing me, because I just, you know, dealt with everything that way. So anyway, my higher power is more of acceptance of life. And now, I can tell you, I always joke, I said, when I was coming back and getting abstinent, I needed a sponsor way more than I needed a higher power, you know? Now, I know today my sponsor was some kind of a bridge to a higher power, but I needed somebody else, because I love the grounded out concept of higher powers in 12-step programs, where it says God, myself, and another human being. Because I think that's for me. I have a disease. I have a disease that's going to warp every possible thing I think of. And I've always said I could go up onto a mountain and meditate and try and commune with God and come down and and be convinced that chocolate's now a vegetable. You know? But then I call my sponsor and I say, God told me, you know, chocolate's a vegetable. And he's going to be like, nah, I don't think so. Not today. But, you know, that's the problem I have is I really can try to listen for my higher power, but I'm also an addict. So I don't know whether I'm hearing the voice of my higher power or am I just hearing the voice of my disease, just doing a really good impression of my higher power, right? So that's the reason I really like to always, I believe God talks through everybody. I really do. I mean, everything that's come along, you know, I've gotten almost everything's come from somebody else. You know, I'm just really good at remembering and keeping the high points. In fact, you know, like I said, I changed careers a couple of years ago and I became a drug and alcohol counselor. And they think I'm brilliant. And you know why? Because I tell them all the things that we talk about every day in these meetings. You know, I just maybe tweak them a little so they're a little more secular. But this is all wisdom I got from the 12 steps and from being with you guys and having you guys, you know, say things where I could really identify things. Some people would verbalize things I've been walking around with for years in my head. Oh, my God, that's it, you know. And that's why, you know, we talk about, you know, it's a we program. You know, this is an experiential. It's meant to be done in a group, you know. My fourth and fifth step, I you know, I would, like every newcomer, I wrote like a, you know, a Russian novel-sized fourth step and read it to my sponsor. And I walked out of that, doing that fifth step, like I was walking on air. It was the first time in like 10 years I could look people in the eye, you know, because I had gotten rid of that. And I really felt from that point forward, I was leaving John 1.0 behind. And I was going to bring John 2.0, you know, into existence. Okay. And then 6 and 7. I heard a great... Okay, now he's in trouble. But the people I like end up in trouble. So I can't, you know, I can't talk about Cosby anymore. I can't. But there's a guy named Russell Brand who I really like, and he's written book on, he's in recovery, and he's written books, and he does his version of 12 steps. Go home and Google Russell Brand 12 steps. It's very funny. It's you have to have no trouble with the F word because it's used constantly. But the one point he made about 6 and 7, he says, 6 and 7 are about our patterns. He said, the same stuff that got me in trouble in grammar school was the same stuff that got me in trouble in college with relationships with. And it's about being willing to look at that because that's the way you break the patterns. Being willing to, you know, and again, it, you know, these are very, you know, entirely ready. I got to be willing to give up even the ones I, yeah, you know, these are really good. I don't want to give them up. But I have to have some faith that they'll be replaced by something better, you know. And they have, you know, I can say I did another fourth step, I don't know, about 5 years ago. And there were so many things on it that weren't on the first one, you know, because I didn't realize that they were wrong when I did the first one, you know. You get better about that. And then, you know, 8 and 9, I tried to do as many amends as I could. And I actually had a real good feeling about amends. I know some people are like, ah. And in my first month in 12-step land, there was a guy who got up every day, and his name was Stanley. He was a carpenter or a painter or something like that. And he said, oh, I, you know, when I was drinking, my best friend, I really screwed him over. He almost lost his business because I was working for him and quit. And I really have to make amends. And he said this like every meeting he came to. And so finally, one day he comes walking into this meeting and he's whistling and he's all happy. And I said, hey, what, you seem awful happy. And he says, yeah, I finally got a chance to make that amends. I said, yeah, I called my boss. I said, well, it must have gone well. He said, no, as a matter of fact, he told me to F myself and hung up the phone. And I said, well, what are you happy about? He says, because it's his problem now. He genuinely, to the bottom of his heart, wanted to make it better. He wanted to clean up his side of the street. And if that person chooses to hold on to it, then they hold on to it. And unfortunately, that means Stanley's living rent-free in his head. And hopefully, he let it go. And then 10, 11, and 12, I mean, are the keep-up steps, the things I have to do constantly, you know. you know, you hear them talking about, you know, we come in the program and we peel the onion, you know, and I always say that's great, but they keep making more onion on me, you know, you know, but I do, I find more things and I work on more things. And, you know, I was just talking to a therapist about this week, about how different I am than I was even like 5 or 10 years ago. I'm the one who calms everybody else down. I'm the one who says, don't worry, we're going to take care of this. I'm the one that doesn't get, I didn't get upset about many things. I used to all the time. I used to joke I walked around 5 degrees off boiling, you know. And you meet me and I'm 5 degrees, I'm fine, I'm happy guy. But boy, you bring me up 5 degrees, watch out, right? And because I'm a guy, I won't speak for all guys, but we tend to funnel all of the things up to anger, you know. You know, I do this one class, they talk about the anger iceberg, because the anger is a secondary emotion. What's under it is either hurt or fear or embarrassment or shame or one of those things. And I didn't ever want to deal with that, so it would come out as anger. But the more I worked on these things and the more I worked on myself, that, you know, things really, really changed, you know, because I was just, I wanted to get better, you know. And I mean, I always think of God, what a world this would be if they were all sort of, look, you all are sitting here on a Saturday night at 5, well, it's not 5:30 anymore, 6 something, you know, you could be doing anything and you're here. And why? Because you want to be better people. Imagine what that world would be like, right? Well, and that's the great thing, because it isn't just about getting, you know, I would say it's not about getting thin, it's about getting well. And well, physically, yes, but emotionally, mentally, and then spiritually. Because I believe that it gets lost a lot of times, but I think the emotional, mental part is the bridge between the spiritual and the physical. And it's the symptoms I use of my spiritual sickness, right? And so I, you know, I can just thank that so many things have changed. So few things really bother me. And now I get to go do this for other people. And I work at a treatment center that has a lot of 20 to 25-year-old failure to launch little rich kids. for what they charge. Anyway, but I tell them, I said, you know, when you get to my age, if you wanted one thing in life, it's a time machine. A time machine to go back and tell the dumbass 20-year-old me all the things I know now, you know, and how things could change. But I can't, right? But I tell them, let me do it for you. You know, I'm no great genius. I'm just like the guy walking ahead on the road full of landmines, and I've stepped on every one of them, you know. And I just try to talk to them about these things. And again, I am just the king of reworking program concepts in a way that they come out. You know, again, I got loads of psych classes and all that stuff. And it's so funny, I watch all that stuff and I think, you know, I can tell you where this is in 12 steps. You know, I can read about one thing and go, okay, yeah, I know where, page, you know, 84, there's a thing about that. And so that's the thing. I think it isn't about just getting thin and well. It's about doing so and being happy. You know, I always said if I had to be sober and miserable, if I had to be absent and miserable, I'm not a masochist. I'd be eating. I'd be drinking, you know. But what they promised me here is I could do that. You know, pages 132 and 133 in the big book talk about being happy, joyous, and free. We are not a glum lot. And my favorite one in that two-page thing, avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. And boy, I was a killer manufacturer of misery all that time. And I don't have to do it now. And again, the only thing I can say is somewhere along the way, God decided that I'd had enough. You know, why? I remember I got abstinent on Monday because that's what you do, right? You know, nobody starts on a weekend. And I made it to Thursday night, and I really wanted to eat. And I said, John, if you want to eat and you want to go binge, fine. But you don't do it until after tomorrow morning's abstinent breakfast. And that changed how I saw it. And I did, you know, how many times did I talk about one day at a time? Out the window, right? And call someone when you want to eat. I'm not going to call anybody. They're going to try and talk me out of eating, right? But I did. I picked up the phone, and it changed things. And again, it changed her trajectory. But, you know, I must have done, I don't know how many Mondays before that, and it didn't work. And why that one worked and all the others didn't, that doesn't come from me, you know. I'm not going to take credit for that. I, you know, my own best thinking got me, you know, to 300 pounds and I tell people about my last drunk. I woke up passed out on the floor with a stream of vomit going across the rug. And I didn't think about it until about 10 years ago when maybe it was a little less. There was a pitcher with the Los Angeles Angels who died because he passed out on his back and he aspirated his own vomit. And I realized there was no reason I couldn't have been passed out on my back. So, you know, I'm meant to be here. I don't know why. Maybe to say something stupid that somebody's going to pick up today and help. And again, all I'm doing is passing most of these things on that were passed on to me from somebody else. So that's about what I got. Okay. Okay. I'm going to take that.
I think you still have to stay there.
What?
Does he have to stay there?
Oh, am I?
At least a question or two.
Oh, okay, sure. I'm sorry. Hey, Rod, you're going to ask me about the treasury of the intergroup. No, I'm just kidding.
Not today. John, yeah. Thank you for a really meaningful and intimate lead. Mm-hmm. You know, working these steps can result in a much lighter heart. Mm-hmm. And the growth of self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Where have you, or how do you draw on things around you to build your self-esteem?
Okay, well, that's a good question.
How
do I work on building self-esteem? Well, first of all, I run this group on narrative therapy, and I talk about we're all the culmination of all the stories we got in our lives, stories from our parents, stories from everybody, stories from society. And one of the things is that we're supposed to, you know, making mistakes is somehow wrong. We got to do the best we can. We got to beat the crap out of ourselves if we don't do it right and all those things. And if finally, a guy named Harlan does this. He says this line where no matter how much I work the steps and memorize the big book, I don't rise above the level of human being. You know, and I got thinking one day, you know, we're all just these little kids running around in these adult suits, if you think about it. And the thing is, none of us got the manual, you know, the manual on how to do life, how to get along with everybody, how to take things in stride and deal all those things. So we spent our lives in a series of, you know, trial and error. And some of my errors affect you, some of your errors affect me. And the other thing is I look back at every error I've ever done and beat the crap out of myself. You know, I never look at the good stuff. I never look at the good decisions. Oh, if only I had done, well, I don't know. You know, you aggrandize the road not taken. It might have been worse, right? So the thing that changed is I finally was able to accept I'm a human being, you know. And there's a lady, it's an outside issue, but she always talks about self-compassion versus self-esteem. She says self-esteem is usually you sort of judging yourself from where you are to perfection. And if you do that, we're all screwed, right? Perfection, right? She sort of says grade yourself on the human curve. You know, how are you doing? Are you a good human being? Are you trying the best you can? Yeah, you're failing left and right. You're making stupid decisions constantly. But are you doing that? And today, I am. I know I'm doing the best I can. And as a result, you know, I think, yeah, I know I like myself. I know I don't do anything deliberately to hurt anybody. And it makes you bulletproof because if somebody insults you, you know it's their problem, you know. And if I did do something, I'm the first to, you know, the 10th step taught me. Just fess up right away and be willing. So anyway, thanks, Rod, for the question.
It is now time for our seventh tradition. While we have no dues or fees, we do have expenses for this meeting.